Chapter 1. A boarding school. "Are you for a walk?" said Montreville to his companion, as they arose from table. "Are you for a walk? Or shall we order the chaise and proceed to Portsmouth?" Belcourt preferred the former, and they sauntered out to view the town, and to make remarks on the inhabitants, as they returned from church. Montreville was a lieutenant in the army, Belcourt was his brother officer. They had been to take leave of their friends previous to their departure for America, and were now returning to Portsmouth, where the troops waited orders for embarkation. They had stopped at Chichester to dine, and knowing they had sufficient time to reach the place of destination before dark, and yet allow them a walk, had resolved, it being Sunday afternoon, to take a survey of the Chichester ladies as they returned from their devotions. They had gratified their curiosity, and were preparing to return to the inn without honoring any of the bells with particular notice, when Madame Dupont, at the head of her school, descended from the church. Such an assemblage of youth and innocence naturally attracted the young soldiers. They stopped, and, as the little cavalcade passed, almost involuntarily pulled off their hats. A tall, elegant girl looked at Montreville and blushed. He instantly recollected the features of Charlotte Temple, whom he had once seen and danced with at a ball at Portsmouth. At that time he thought on her only as a very lovely child, she being then only 13, but the improvement 2 years had made in her person, and the blush of recollection which suffused her cheeks as she passed, awakened in his bosom new and pleasing ideas. Vanity led him to think that pleasure at again beholding him might have occasioned the emotion he had witnessed, and the same vanity led him to wish to see her again. "She is the sweetest girl in the world," said he, as he entered the inn. Belcourt stared. "Did you not notice her?" continued Montreville. "She had on a blue bonnet, and with a pair of lovely eyes of the same color, has contrived to make me feel devilish odd about the heart." "Foe," said Belcourt, "a musket ball from our friends, the Americans, may in less than 2 months make you feel worse." "I never think of the future," replied Montreville, "but am determined to make the most of the present, and would willingly compound with any kind familiar who would inform me who the girl is, and how I might be likely to obtain an interview." But no kind familiar at that time appearing, and the chaise which they had ordered, driving up to the door, Montreville and his companion were obliged to take leave of Chichester and its fair inhabitant, and proceed on their journey. But Charlotte had made too great an impression on his mind to be easily eradicated, having therefore spent 3 whole days in thinking on her and in endeavoring to form some plan for seeing her. He determined to set off for Chichester, and trust to chance either to favor or frustrate his designs. Arriving at the verge of the town, he dismounted, and sending the servant forward with the horses, proceeded toward the place, where, in the midst of an extensive pleasure ground, stood the mansion which contained the lovely Charlotte Temple. Montreville leaned on a broken gate, and looked earnestly at the house. The wall which surrounded it was high, and perhaps the Arguses who guarded the Hesperian fruit within, were more watchful than those famed of old. "'Tis a romantic attempt," said he, "and should I even succeed in seeing and conversing with her, it can be productive of no good. I must of necessity leave England in a few days, and probably may never return. Why then should I endeavor to engage the affections of this lovely girl, only to leave her a prey to 1,000 inquietudes, of which at present she has no idea? I will return to Portsmouth and think no more about her." The evening now was closed, a serene stillness reigned, and the chaste queen of night with her silver crescent faintly illuminated the hemisphere. The mind of Montreville was hushed into composure by the serenity of the surrounding objects. "I will think on her no more," said he, and turned with an intention to leave the place, but as he turned, he saw the gate which led to the pleasure grounds open, and 2 women come out, who walked arm in arm across the field. "I will at least see who these are," said he. He overtook them, and giving them the compliments of the evening, begged leave to see them into the more frequented parts of the town. But how was he delighted, when, waiting for an answer, he discovered, under the concealment of a large bonnet, the face of Charlotte Temple. He soon found means to ingratiate himself with her companion, who was a French teacher at the school, and, at parting, slipped a letter he had purposely written, into Charlotte's hand, and 5 guineas into that of Mademoiselle, who promised she would endeavor to bring her young charge into the field again the next evening. Chapter 2. Domestic Concerns. Mr. Temple was the youngest son of a nobleman whose fortune was by no means adequate to the antiquity, grandeur, and I may add, pride of the family. He saw his elder brother made completely wretched by marrying a disagreeable woman, whose fortune helped to prop the sinking dignity of the house, and he beheld his sisters legally prostituted to old, decrepit men, whose titles gave them consequence in the eyes of the world, and whose affluence rendered them splendidly miserable. "I will not sacrifice internal happiness for outward show," said he, "I will seek content, And, if I find her in a cottage, will embrace her with as much cordiality as I should have seated on a throne. Mr. Temple possessed a small estate of about £500 a year, and with that he resolved to preserve independence, to marry where the feelings of his heart should direct him, and to confine his expenses within the limits of his income. He had a heart open to every generous feeling of humanity, and a hand ready to dispense to those who wanted part of the blessings he enjoyed himself. As he was universally known to be the friend of the unfortunate, his advice and bounty was frequently solicited, nor was it seldom that he sought out indigent merit, and raised it from obscurity, confining his own expenses within a very narrow compass. "You are a benevolent fellow," said a young officer to him one day, "and I have a great mind to give you a fine subject to exercise the goodness of your heart upon." "You cannot oblige me more," said Temple, "than to point out any way by which I can be serviceable to my fellow creatures." "Come along then," said the young man, "we will go and visit a man who is not in so good a lodging as he deserves, and, were it not that he has an angel with him, who comforts and supports him, he must long since have sunk under his misfortunes." The young man's heart was too full to proceed, and Temple, unwilling to irritate his feelings by making further inquiries, followed him in silence, till they arrived at the Fleet Prison. The officer inquired for Captain Eldridge. A person led them up several pair of dirty stairs, and pointing to a door which led to a miserable, small apartment, said that was the captain's room, and retired. The officer, whose name was Blakeney, tapped at the door, and was bid to enter by a voice melodiously soft. He opened the door, and discovered to Temple a scene which riveted him to the spot with astonishment. The apartment, though small, and bearing strong marks of poverty, was neat in the extreme. In an armchair, his head reclined upon his hand, his eyes fixed on a book which lay open before him, sat an aged man in a lieutenant's uniform, which, though threadbare, would sooner call a blush of shame into the face of those who could neglect real merit, than cause the hectic of confusion to glow on the cheeks of him who wore it. Beside him sat a lovely creature busied in painting a fan mount. She was fair as the lily, but sorrow had nipped the rose in her cheek before it was half blown. Her eyes were blue, and her hair, which was light brown, was slightly confined under a plain muslin cap, tied round with a black ribbon. A white linen gown and plain lawn handkerchief composed the remainder of her dress, and in this simple attire, she was more irresistibly charming to such a heart as Temple's, than she would have been, if adorned with all the splendor of a courtly belle. When they entered, the old man arose from his seat, and shaking Blakeney by the hand with great cordiality, offered Temple his chair, and there being but three in the room, seated himself on the side of his little bed with evident composure. "This is a strange place," said he to Temple, "to receive visitors of distinction in, but we must fit our feelings to our station. While I am not ashamed to own the cause which brought me here, why should I blush at my situation? Our misfortunes are not our faults, and were it not for that poor girl." Here the philosopher was lost in the father. He rose hastily from his seat, and walking toward the window, wiped off a tear which he was afraid would tarnish the cheek of a sailor. Temple cast his eye on Miss Eldridge. A pellucid drop had stolen from her eyes, and fallen upon a rose she was painting. It blotted and discolored the flower. "'Tis emblematic," said he mentally, "the rose of youth and health soon fades when watered by the tear of affliction. My friend Blakeney," said he, addressing the old man, "told me I could be of service to you. Be so kind then, dear sir, as to point out some way in which I can relieve the anxiety of your heart and increase the pleasures of my own." "My good young man," said Eldridge, "you know not what you offer. While deprived of my liberty I cannot be free from anxiety on my own account, but that is a trifling concern. My anxious thoughts extend to one more dear a thousand times than life. I am a poor weak old man, and must expect in a few years to sink into silence and oblivion. But when I am gone, who will protect that fair bud of innocence from the blasts of adversity, or from the cruel hand of insult and dishonor?" "Oh, my father," cried Miss Eldridge, tenderly taking his hand, "be not anxious on that account, for daily are my prayers offered to heaven that our lives may terminate at the same instant, and one grave receive us both, for why should I live when deprived of my only friend?" Temple was moved even to tears. "You will both live many years," said he, "and I hope see much happiness. Cheerly, my friend, cheerly, these passing clouds of adversity will serve only to make the sunshine of prosperity more pleasing. But we are losing time. You might ere this have told me who are your creditors, what were their demands, and other particulars necessary to your liberation." "My story is short," said Mr. Eldridge, "but there are some particulars which will wring my heart barely to remember, yet to one whose offers of friendship appear so open and disinterested, I will relate every circumstance that led to my present, painful situation. But my child, continued he, addressing his daughter, let me prevail on you to take this opportunity, while my friends are with me, to enjoy the benefit of air and exercise. Go, my love, leave me now, tomorrow at your usual hour I will expect you. Miss Eldridge impressed on his cheek the kiss of filial affection, and obeyed. Chapter 3. Unexpected misfortunes. My life, said Mr. Eldridge, till within these few years was marked by no particular circumstance deserving notice. I early embraced the life of a sailor, and have served my king with unremitted ardor for many years. At the age of 25 I married an amiable woman, one son, and the girl who just now left us, were the fruits of our union. My boy had genius and spirit. I straitened my little income to give him a liberal education, but the rapid progress he made in his studies amply compensated for the inconvenience. At the academy where he received his education he commenced an acquaintance with a Mr. Lewis, a young man of affluent fortune. As they grew up their intimacy ripened into friendship, and they became almost inseparable companions. George chose the profession of a soldier. I had neither friends or money to procure him a commission, and had wished him to embrace a nautical life, but this was repugnant to his wishes, and I ceased to urge him on the subject. The friendship subsisting between Lewis and my son was of such a nature as gave him free access to our family, and so specious was his manner that we hesitated not to state to him all our little difficulties in regard to George's future views. He listened to us with attention, and offered to advance any sum necessary for his first setting out. I embraced the offer, and gave him my note for the payment of it, but he would not suffer me to mention any stipulated time, as he said I might do it whenever most convenient to myself. About this time my dear Lucy returned from school, and I soon began to imagine Lewis looked at her with eyes of affection. I gave my child a caution to beware of him, and to look on her mother as her friend. She was unaffectedly artless, and when, as I suspected, Lewis made professions of love, she confided in her parents, and assured us her heart was perfectly unbiased in his favor, and she would cheerfully submit to our direction. I took an early opportunity of questioning him concerning his intentions towards my child. He gave an equivocal answer, and I forbade him the house. The next day he sent and demanded payment of his money. It was not in my power to comply with the demand. I requested 3 days to endeavor to raise it, determining in that time to mortgage my half pay, and live on a small annuity which my wife possessed, rather than be under an obligation to so worthless a man, but this short time was not allowed me, for that evening, as I was sitting down to supper, unsuspicious of danger, an officer entered, and tore me from the embraces of my family. My wife had been for some time in a declining state of health, ruin at once so unexpected and inevitable was a stroke she was not prepared to bear, and I saw her feigned into the arms of our servant, as I left my own habitation for the comfortless walls of a prison. My poor Lucy, distracted with her fears for us both, sunk on the floor and endeavored to detain me by her feeble efforts, but in vain, they forced open her arms, she shrieked, and fell prostrate. But pardon me. The horrors of that night unmanned me. I cannot proceed. He rose from his seat, and walked several times across the room. At length, attaining more composure, he cried, "What a mere infant I am! Why, sir, I never felt thus in the day of battle." "No," said Temple, "but the truly brave soul is tremblingly alive to the feelings of humanity." "True," replied the old man, something like satisfaction darting across his features, "and painful as these feelings are, I would not exchange them for that torpor which the Stoic mistakes for philosophy. How many exquisite delights should I have passed by unnoticed, but for these keen sensations, this quick sense of happiness or misery? Then let us, my friend, take the cup of life as it is presented to us, tempered by the hand of a wise providence, be thankful for the good, be patient under the evil, and presume not to inquire why the latter predominates." "This is true philosophy," said Temple. "'Tis the only way to reconcile ourselves to the cross events of life," replied he. "But I forget myself. I will not longer intrude on your patience, but proceed in my melancholy tale. The very evening that I was taken to prison, my son arrived from Ireland, where he had been some time with his regiment. From the distracted expressions of his mother and sister, he learnt by whom I had been arrested, and, late as it was, flew on the wings of wounded affection, to the house of his false friend, and earnestly inquired the cause of this cruel conduct. With all the calmness of a cool, deliberate villain, he avowed his passion for Lucy, declared her situation in life would not permit him to marry her, but offered to release me immediately, and make any settlement on her, if George would persuade her to live, as he impiously termed it, a life of honor. Fired at the insult offered to a man and a soldier, my boy struck the villain, and a challenge ensued. He then went to a coffee house in the neighborhood and wrote a long affectionate letter to me, blaming himself severely for having introduced Lewis into the family, or permitted him to confer an obligation, which had brought inevitable ruin on us all. He begged me, whatever might be the event of the ensuing morning, not to suffer regret or unavailing sorrow for his fate, to increase the anguish of my heart, which he greatly feared was already insupportable. This letter was delivered to me early in the morning. It would be vain to attempt describing my feelings on the perusal of it, suffice it to say, that a merciful providence interposed, and I was for 3 weeks insensible to miseries almost beyond the strength of human nature to support. A fever and strong delirium seized me, and my life was despaired of. At length, nature, overpowered with fatigue, gave way to the salutary power of rest, and a quiet slumber of some hours restored me to reason, though the extreme weakness of my frame prevented my feeling my distress so acutely as I otherwise should. The first object that struck me on awaking, was Lucy sitting by my bedside. Her pale countenance and sable dress prevented my inquiries for poor George, for the letter I had received from him, was the first thing that occurred to my memory. By degrees the rest returned. I recollected being rested, but could no ways account for being in this apartment, whither they had conveyed me during my illness. I was so weak as to be almost unable to speak. I pressed Lucy's hand, and looked earnestly round the apartment in search of another dear object. "Where is your mother?" said I, faintly. The poor girl could not answer. She shook her head in expressive silence, and throwing herself on the bed, folded her arms about me, and burst into tears. "What? Both gone?" said I. "Both," she replied, endeavoring to restrain her emotions, "but they are happy, no doubt." Here Mr. Aldridge paused. The recollection of the scene was too painful to permit him to proceed. Chapter 4. Change of Fortune. It was some days, continued Mr. Eldridge, recovering himself, before I could venture to inquire the particulars of what had happened during my illness. At length I assumed courage to ask my dear girl how long her mother and brother had been dead. She told me, that the morning after my rest, George came home early to inquire after his mother's health, stayed with them but a few minutes, seemed greatly agitated at parting, but gave them strict charge to keep up their spirits, and hope everything would turn out for the best. In about 2 hours after, as they were sitting at breakfast, and endeavoring to strike out some plan to attain my liberty, they heard a loud rap at the door, which Lucy running to open, she met the bleeding body of her brother, borne in by two men who had lifted him from a litter, on which they had brought him from the place where he fought. Her poor mother, weakened by illness and the struggles of the preceding night, was not able to support this shock, gasping for breath, her looks wild and haggard, she reached the apartment where they had carried her dying son. She knelt by the bedside, and taking his cold hand, "My poor boy," said she, "I will not be parted from thee, husband, son, both at once lost. Father of mercies, spare me." She fell into a strong convulsion, and expired in about 2 hours. In the meantime, a surgeon had dressed George's wounds, but they were in such a situation as to bar the smallest hopes of recovery. He never was sensible from the time he was brought home, and died that evening in the arms of his sister. Late as it was when this event took place, my affectionate Lucy insisted on coming to me. "What must he feel," said she, "at our apparent neglect, and how shall I inform him of the afflictions with which it has pleased heaven to visit us?" She left the care of the dear departed ones to some neighbors who had kindly come in to comfort and assist her, and on entering the house where I was confined, found me in the situation I have mentioned. How she supported herself in these trying moments, I know not. Heaven, no doubt, was with her, and her anxiety to preserve the life of one parent in some measure abated her affliction for the loss of the other. My circumstances were greatly embarrassed, my acquaintance few, and those few utterly unable to assist me. When my wife and son were committed to their kindred earth, my creditors seized my house and furniture, which not being sufficient to discharge all their demands, detainers were lodged against me. No friend stepped forward to my relief. From the grave of her mother, my beloved Lucy followed an almost dying father to this melancholy place. Here we have been nearly a year and a half. My half-pay I have given up to satisfy my creditors, and my child supports me by her industry, sometimes by fine needlework, sometimes by painting. She leaves me every night, and goes to a lodging near the bridge, but returns in the morning, to cheer me with her smiles, and bless me by her duteous affection. A lady once offered her an asylum in her family, but she would not leave me. "We are all the world to each other," said she. "I thank God, I have health and spirits to improve the talents with which nature has endowed me, and I trust if I employ them in the support of a beloved parent, I shall not be thought an unprofitable servant. While he lives, I pray for strength to pursue my employment, and when it pleases heaven to take one of us, may it give the survivor resignation to bear the separation as we ought, till then I will never leave him. But where is this inhuman persecutor? Said Temple. He has been abroad ever since, replied the old man, but he has left orders with his lawyer never to give up the note till the utmost farthing is paid. And how much is the amount of your debts in all? Said Temple. £500, he replied. Temple started, it was more than he expected. But something must be done, said he, that sweet maid must not wear out her life in a prison. I will see you again tomorrow, my friend, said he, shaking Aldridge's hand, keep up your spirits, light and shade are not more happily blended than are the pleasures and pains of life, and the horrors of the one serve only to increase the splendor of the other. You never lost a wife and son, said Aldridge. No, replied he, but I can feel for those that have. Aldridge pressed his hand as they went toward the door, and they parted in silence. When they got without the walls of the prison, Temple thanked his friend Blakeney for introducing him to so worthy a character, and telling him he had a particular engagement in the city, wished him a good evening. And what is to be done for this distressed man, said Temple, as he walked up Ludgate Hill. Would to heaven I had a fortune that would enable me instantly to discharge his debt. What exquisite transport, to see the expressive eyes of Lucy beaming at once with pleasure for her father's deliverance, and gratitude for her deliverer. But is not my fortune affluence, continued he, nay superfluous wealth, when compared to the extreme indigence of Eldridge, and what have I done to deserve ease and plenty, while a brave worthy officer starves in a prison? 300 a year is surely sufficient for all my wants and wishes, at any rate Eldridge must be relieved. When the heart has will, the hands can soon find means to execute a good action. Temple was a young man, his feelings warm and impetuous, unacquainted with the world, his heart had not been rendered callous by being convinced of its fraud and hypocrisy. He pitied their sufferings, overlooked their faults, thought every bosom as generous as his own, and would cheerfully have divided his last guinea with an unfortunate fellow creature. No wonder, then, that such a man, without waiting a moment for the interference of Madame Prudence, should resolve to raise money sufficient for the relief of Eldridge, by mortgaging part of his fortune. We will not inquire too minutely into the cause which might actuate him in this instance, suffice it to say, he immediately put the plan in execution, and in 3 days from the time he first saw the unfortunate lieutenant, he had the superlative felicity of seeing him at liberty, and receiving an ample reward in the tearful eye and half-articulated thanks of the grateful Lucy. And pray, young man, said his father to him one morning, what are your designs in visiting thus constantly that old man and his daughter? Temple was at a loss for a reply, he had never asked himself the question, he hesitated, and his father continued. It was not till within these few days that I heard in what manner your acquaintance first commenced, and cannot suppose anything but attachment to the daughter could carry you such imprudent lengths for the father. It certainly must be her art that drew you into mortgage part of your fortune. Art, sir! Cried Temple eagerly. Lucy Eldridge is as free from art as she is from every other error, she is. Everything that is amiable and lovely, said his father, interrupting him ironically, no doubt in your opinion she is a pattern of excellence for all her sex to follow, but come, sir, pray tell me what are your designs towards this paragon. I hope you do not intend to complete your folly by marrying her. Were my fortune such as would support her according to her merit, I don't know a woman more formed to ensure happiness in the married state. Then prithee, my dear lad, said his father, since your rank and fortune are so much beneath what your princess might expect, be so kind as to turn your eyes on Miss Weatherby, who, having only an estate of 3,000 a year, is more upon a level with you, and whose father yesterday solicited the mighty honor of your alliance. I shall leave you to consider on this offer, and pray or remember, that your union with Miss Weatherby will put it in your power to be more liberally the friend of Lucy Eldridge. The old gentleman walked in a stately manner out of the room, and Temple stood almost petrified with astonishment, contempt, and rage. Chapter 5. Such things are. Miss Weatherby was the only child of a wealthy man, almost idolized by her parents, flattered by her dependents, and never contradicted even by those who called themselves her friends. I cannot give a better description than by the following lines. The lovely maid whose form and face nature has decked with every grace, but in whose breast no virtues glow, whose heart ne'er felt another's woe, whose hand ne'er smoothed the bed of pain, or eased the captive's galling chain, but like the tulip caught the eye, born just to be unmirrored and die, when gone, no one regrets its loss, or scarce remembers that it was. Such was Miss Weatherby, her form lovely as nature could make it, but her mind uncultivated, her heart unfeeling, her passions impetuous, and her brain almost turned with flattery, dissipation, and pleasure, and such was the girl, whom a partial grandfather left independent mistress of the fortune before mentioned. She had seen Temple frequently, and fancying she could never be happy without him, nor once imagining he could refuse a girl of her beauty and fortune, she prevailed on her fond father to offer the alliance to the old Earl of D., Mr. Temple's father. The Earl had received the offer courteously, he thought it a great match for Henry, and was too fashionable a man to suppose a wife could be any impediment to the friendship he professed for Eldridge and his daughter. Unfortunately for Temple, he thought quite otherwise. The conversation he had just had with his father discovered to him the situation of his heart, and he found that the most affluent fortune would bring no increase of happiness unless Lucy Eldridge shared it with him, and the knowledge of the purity of her sentiments, and the integrity of his own heart, made him shudder at the idea his father had started, of marrying a woman for no other reason than because the affluence of her fortune would enable him to injure her by maintaining in splendor the woman to whom his heart was devoted. He therefore resolved to refuse Miss Weatherby, and be the event what it might, offer his heart and hand to Lucy Eldridge. Full of this determination, he fought his father, declared his resolution, and was commanded never more to appear in his presence. Temple bowed, his heart was too full to permit him to speak, he left the house precipitately, and hastened to relate the cause of his sorrows to his good old friend and his amiable daughter. In the meantime, the Earl, vexed to the soul that such a fortune should be lost, determined to offer himself a candidate for Miss Weatherby's favor. What wonderful changes are wrought by that reigning power, ambition! The lovesick girl, when first she heard of Temple's refusal, wept, raved, tore her hair, and vowed to found a Protestant nunnery with her fortune, and by commencing abbess, shut herself up from the sight of cruel ungrateful man forever. Her father was a man of the world, he suffered this first transport to subside, and then very deliberately unfolded to her the offers of the old Earl, expatiated on the many benefits arising from an elevated title, painted in glowing colors the surprise and vexation of Temple when he should see her figuring as a countess and his mother-in-law, and begged her to consider well before she made any rash vows. The distressed fair one dried her tears, listened patiently, and at length declared she believed the surest method to revenge the slight put on her by the son would be to accept the father. So said, so done, and in a few days she became the Countess D. Temple heard the news with emotion. He had lost his father's favor by avowing his passion for Lucy, and he saw now there was no hope of regaining it. "But he shall not make me miserable," said he. "Lucy and I have no ambitious notions. We can live on 300 a year for some little time, till the mortgage is paid off, and then we shall have sufficient not only for the comforts but many of the little elegancies."